Geithner gets the third degree this morning from Congress.
If he knew about the LIBOR thing 5 years ago, what did he do about it? Hey, everybody, I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Wednesday, July 25th. Well, the Olympics haven't started, but the Games certainly have. A look at some of the usual and unusual bets about the Olympics.
And we're also going to talk with one of the fastest men on the planet. He's America's number one competitor in the 800 meter, but he also is known for his outspokenness about trying to make money as he heads to the Olympics. We'll talk with Nick Simmons later on the podcast. It's the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
What did you know about this whole LIBOR thing, and when did you know it? That's the essence of the in-person grilling Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner is getting this morning from the House Financial Services Committee.
Geithner has said he was aware of LIBOR rate rigging as early as 2007 when he was chair of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, but it's less clear what the New York Fed did about it. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer is here with the latest. Hello, Nancy.
Good morning.
Nancy, why the grilling?
Well, Geithner was officially presenting a report from the Financial Stability Oversight Council on the state of the economy. But the toughest questions were about British banks' manipulation of the LIBOR interest rate. And of course, LIBOR is used to set interest rates for mortgages, student loans, and car loans around the world. Mm-hmm. At the time, Geithner was head of the New York Fed.
And he has said that he had inklings, at least, of what was going on with LIBOR back in 2007. What kind of tough questions did he get about that today?
Well, he got a lot of what did you know and when did you know it types of questions, Jeff. Some of the sharpest questions came from Congressman Jeb Hensarling. He's a Republican from Texas. Here's a bit of the back and forth between Hensarling and Geithner. Hensarling starts out by asking Geithner why there wasn't a tougher response when the LIBOR manipulation first came to light.
It appears that you treated it almost as a curiosity or something akin to jaywalking as opposed to highway robbery.
And Geithner replies that he did tell top U.S. regulators about the problem.
We were very concerned
apparently
about that, and we just thought what we decided to do was to try to initiate a reform of the process with the British, but also just to make sure the relevant authorities made use of it.
And Jeff, Geithner was also asked whether he was aware of the possibility of fraud with LIBOR. Mm-hmm. He said he was aware of the risks that banks would be tempted to tamper with LIBOR, and there would be more questions about LIBOR, more grilling of Geithner tomorrow when he testifies before the Senate Banking Committee.
Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer, thank you.
You're welcome.
Meanwhile, Britain's largest banks are under pressure to fess up to how much the LIBOR scandal is likely to cost them. And European lawmakers have proposed making interest rate rigging a crime. From London, here's Marketplace's Stephen Beard.
Many investors were surprised to learn that manipulating LIBOR is not apparently illegal under European law. The interest rate is a vital benchmark for global financial transactions. But the fact that it's based on data voluntarily supplied by the banks means that criminal sanctions do not seem to apply. Today, the European Union aims to put that right. It's publishing plans to make LIBOR interest rate rigging a criminal offence. But as lawyer Zia Ullah told the BBC, this won't punish past wrongdoing.
It will criminalise the fixing and manipulation of LIBOR and Euribor going forward, but it won't be retrospective, so it won't cover the activities that may already have taken place.
Barclays, however, has been slapped with a big regulatory fine and could face a bill for more than $1 billion in US civil lawsuit damages. Worried investors are now calling on all the banks involved to estimate how much the scandal is likely to cost them. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The Olympics get underway later this week, but the betting has already started. People are betting on all things Olympic, from the usual bets, like who will win certain events, to the less usual bets. Here to tell us about some of those is Joe Crilly with the British betting agency William Hill. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning.
So, Joe, tell me about some of these bets that people can place.
Well, I mean, in addition to the sports that we take bets on, we're betting on every single event at the Olympics. But we also take a few wacky wagers, as we like to call them as well, that are quite popular with our punters and also quite popular with people in the press as well. the weather and Britain go hand in hand, and it's usually bad weather, despite the fact that we're in the middle of a mini heat wave at the moment. But we're actually offering 8 to 11, so that's odds on that rain will fall during the opening ceremony.
Well, so how popular are these more unusual bets, or how big of a business is Olympic betting?
Well, it's very big indeed. Because punters only really have the chance to bet on them every 4 years, they are quite popular, and it also gives fans of peripheral sports like synchronized swimming, water polo, rowing, it gives them the chance to have a bet on their sports, because we don't usually bet on them throughout the rest of the year. We can very much see turnover for this Olympics being, I'd say, 100% bigger than the turnover for the Beijing Games.
How much is Olympic betting worth?
It's really hard to put a figure on it, because since the 2008 Games, we've brought in mobile betting. We're offering bets on every single event during the Games. So it's hard to really put a figure on it, but it will be well within eight figures, I would have said.
Wow. And I do have to ask you about one of your most lucrative bets, I guess, if it is one. Apparently it involves a UFO.
Yes. Our punters, if they are looking for the big odds, if they are slightly supernaturally inclined, we're offering 1,000 to 1 that a UFO is spotted over the Olympic Stadium during the opening ceremony of the game. So that would mean if you were to put a pound on, and in the very unlikely event that a UFO does fly over the stadium, you would win £1,000 from just that £1 investment.
Well, Joe Quilley is a spokesperson for British betting agency William Hill. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you very much.
Nick Simmons is one of the world's fastest men. He's America's top Olympic qualifier in the 800 meters. He's also literally the poster boy for athlete entrepreneurism. Simmons auctioned off his left shoulder as a billboard. A Milwaukee ad agency paid $11,000 on eBay for that space. Nick Simmons now sports the agency's logo as a temporary tattoo. But when Simmons, his tattoo, and his money-making message show up at the Olympics, that's when things get a little messy. Nick Simmons is at the Games in London, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me.
Why do you have to cover that sponsor's tattoo when you're on the track?
Yeah, well, the various governing bodies that control track and field and the Olympic Games, you know, it's IAAF for track and field events, and then the IOC, of course, for Olympic events.
Uh-huh.
You know, they want to protect the event sponsors, and they think that if athletes represent their individual sponsors in any way, it could lessen that investment by the event sponsors. So in my case, it would be Nike. I'm allowed to represent Nike on my uniform and my spikes, but anything other than that has to be covered up.
In a general sense, what is it that you want to be able to do with your body, with your name, that you're not able to do now?
Well, really, I think that the athletes are only able to attend these meetings with a lot of help from their partners and their sponsors throughout the years. And I've had so many teammates that have been forced into early retirement simply because they couldn't make ends meet. And I also know of thousands of companies, especially back in the States, that would love to invest in these athletes, but say to the athletes, you know, gosh, I'd love to invest, but I have to be able to get a return on my investment somehow. Is there any way you could display our corporate logo anywhere at any time? And according to the IAAF, no, there's not.
So getting to the heart of this now, and it sounds like we are, I mean, this is about you and other athletes being able to make, and I don't mean anything pejorative by this, being able to make more money. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, we're trying to run a business here. I specifically like to view this sport as trying to run a business. I've incorporated Nick Simmons LLC, specializes in competing, you know, domestically and abroad. You know, to run a business, I have to be able to give my partners a return on their investment.
Since ancient Greece, the Olympics have been a quote unquote an amateur sporting competition. Is there nothing to be said for trying to hang on, and that seems like what the IOC is trying to do here, trying to hang on to some pure vestige of that?
I don't know if I'd necessarily say that's what the IOC is trying to do. If you have $6 billion exchanging hands, it just kind of blows my mind that you've got 10,000 athletes who've devoted at least 4 years of their life to becoming part of this show, and everybody is making money, but then they look at the athletes and say, oh, you guys should do your job for free. I kind of don't understand that.
Of course, you want to win the 800 meters in London just to win, of course. But financially, how different are the worlds that await you if you win, or at least place, and if you don't?
Well, and that's really where the financial return comes for the athletes. And that's kind of what we all are in it for, is that if you do manage to win an Olympic gold, or even, you know, in some cases, just medal, you know, the income that will come following that is substantial. But it should be more than that, I feel like. You know, I would like to see a guaranteed salary for everyone who makes the Olympic team. If you were to take some of the TV rights, I think it was $1.7 billion in TV rights, mm-hmm. and divide that up amongst the athletes. You know what I'm saying? I mean, we've got Olympians, Olympic medalists even, that live below the poverty line, and that's not right.
Well, Nick Simmons, what do you say to a runner? Run like the wind? But thanks for talking
with us. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thank you, guys.
And you know, Stacy, the Japanese also happen to have their own controversial money-making runner, as it turns out. Her name is Maya Nakanishi, and she's a Paralympian sprinter, does the 100-meter and 200-meter dash, and she's missing part of her right leg. She was out of options to fund her training and afford the latest prosthetics to race. She was working at McDonald's, and it just was not getting the job done. So she had this idea that she would pose for her own racy calendar. And so she did that. She got a photographer who was known for photographing people who were missing limbs in sort of semi-nude states, I guess. And so anyway, she sold this thing on Amazon and made $50,000.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so now, and she's considered a medal contender at the London Paralympic Games, which follow the Olympics at the end of August.
Wow. Well, sometimes it pays to advertise, I guess.
Advertise yourself in that case.
Exactly.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
We've heard about the cost of the Olympics by now from all kinds of angles, what it means for the city of London, for the athletes. But there's one cost of the games you might not have considered, the price of keeping athletes honest and drug-free. Even before the games have begun, the AP is reporting that over 100 athletes have already been kept out of the London Olympics because of doping suspensions.
Shirley Wang has been covering the games for the Wall Street Journal, and she's with us now for today's Midday Extra. Hi, Shirley.
Hello.
So what's different this year? What kind of measures are the Olympic organizers taking to make sure athletes are clean?
Well, one of the main things that organizers are doing is they're increasing the number of tests. So this is going to be what the organizers call the most tested games ever. They will be taking 5,000 samples from athletes, which is actually about the number that is conducted usually in the whole country here in the UK. They're also going to be using the newest technology possible, including, they just told us in a press briefing just now, a new human growth hormone test. It was approved or on the market just for a few weeks ago. That is actually in place here in London now. In addition, they are using something called the biological passport, which test athletes' blood levels. So rather than looking for the drug itself, it looks to see whether there are changes in the blood that could be indicative of possible doping.
Well, this sounds like a lot of new technology. Shirley, how much is all of this costing?
Well, that number is hard to pinpoint, but for the first time ever, the Olympics has a corporation who has sponsored their anti-doping efforts. So GlaxoSmithKline, a big drug maker, has invested £20 million, which is about $31 million, in creating a state-of-the-art facility and also some services and manpower as well. But that dollar figure has got to be higher than that, because no GSK scientists will be on site during the testing. It'll all be done by people who are connected with the Olympic Committee or with anti-doping agencies.
How different is what we're seeing this year from the sort of resources that have been marshaled in past Olympics?
Well, in some ways, it's just a continuation, because there have been anti-doping efforts since the Olympic Games starting in 1968. It's just that Olympic officials are trying their best to enhance testing efforts to be to both catch people, but also for these tests to serve as a deterrent. The idea that you might be caught, in this case, they're testing about 1 in 2 athletes here at the Games. They're hoping that that will deter people from wanting to cheat when they are at this event.
What kind of resources go into having the best technology to test athletes for doping?
All kinds of testing. For instance, WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, all year round are looking at doing research on new tests. They try to figure out which substances should be added to the banned substances list. And then various agencies around the world are also collecting intelligence on their various athletes in their home countries. They're working with other officials to try and collect information, including things like customs agents, to try and figure out, you know, are there some odd shipments coming in, and might athletes be connected with that? And all of this information gets shared and funneled throughout the year, and athletes are also tested throughout the year to try and, you know, achieve essentially a clean games here in London.
From one Olympics to the next, it makes sense that we would gather experience and technology and be able to throw more at the problem. But what about the other side of this? What about the athletes? Are they not getting the picture? are we having to test more because they're doping more? Or are people actually starting to realize that maybe they shouldn't do it?
Well, one of the experts here at the press briefing said that he would assume that there are athletes who are cheating in these games. So it doesn't seem like all athletes are getting the message. Whether things are actually getting better or not is even hard to characterize. But I think it's fair to say from what the experts are telling us here in the press that this is not a problem that's going to go away. They are doing their best to try and deter things and to keep the games as clean as possible. But there's no doubt in at least one expert's mind that there is indeed doping going on here.
Shirley Wang is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She is in London to cover the games. Shirley, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, we found out 4 years ago that our biggest banks were too big to fail, but it's not like we've been doing anything to shrink them. In fact, 77% of the assets in the U.S. are with the biggest banks. And the guy who practically invented the idea of the mega bank went on TV today to say it's time to break them up. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore is here now with more. Hello, Heidi.
Hi, Jeff.
So, Heidi, you're big on Twitter, and you're on Twitter this morning, and this thing starts exploding. What's the big deal?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the CEO who said this, or former CEO, was Sandy Weill. And so he used to head Citigroup. In fact, he created Citigroup. And he also helped bring down a law known as Glass-Steagall, which kept apart banks that take deposits, banks that advise companies, and insurers. So he was the first one to really lobby against it, combine all of them. I mean, he is the man who created the mega bank as we know it. Hmm. And then he goes on CNBC today, and you hear something like this, his conversation with Becky Quick, the CNBC anchor.
That's a pretty radical idea, though, the idea of breaking up the investment banks and the banks. Are you suggesting going back and really breaking these companies up?
That's exactly what I'm suggesting.
Yeah. So to everyone on Wall Street, this was like invasion of the banker body snatchers. You know, that Sandy Weill would say bygones and say that banks are now too big to trust, that people don't want to invest with them anymore and that we have to change them. That's pretty big.
So he says it. Does that advance the cause of those who actually want to break up the big banks?
I think it does only because there seems to be an impetus towards it. So John Reed was his co-CEO of Citigroup after the merger. He also disavowed the big bank model. Phil Purcell, who was the CEO of Morgan Stanley, recently came out and he said that he doesn't like that model either. So all these ex-CEOs, and mind you, this doesn't affect their money anymore, are coming out and saying this doesn't work. So we have to wait until after the election, but if Wall Street can break itself up from within like this, rather than Congress trying to break it up from the outside, then we're probably going to make some progress.
Marketplace's New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yahoo's new CEO, Marissa Mayer, has been making news, and not just because of her new job. She's decided she'll return to work just a few weeks after having a baby. And that decision has reignited an old debate, as Dan Gorenstein reports.
There is no reason to play the what would I do if I were Marissa Mayer game, says Sharon Lerner.
Whether she decides to take leave or not, the point is that she has the choice.
Lerner, who wrote the book The War on Moms, says most working mothers don't. They need the paycheck. That's why Ellen Galinsky at Families and Work Institute thinks the Mayer drama has hit a nerve.
Women's income has become indispensable to families. 26% of women are earning more than their husbands these days. It's a different time.
Take New England Cable News reporter Lauren Collins, who began planning as soon as she got her due date.
This is perfect. I can have the baby at the end of the summer and come back right in time to cover the election.
But Collins says her boss has said, slow down, take another month.
Everyone that I've talked to has said there will be other elections, but your baby's only going to be a baby once.
Collins says 12 weeks is good, and she'll be back before the inauguration. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Reports issued by the U.S. Department of Agriculture don't usually create ripples beyond a small pond of farmers and investors. Today, though, the USDA releases a much-anticipated briefing, the monthly food price forecast. Everyone from store owners to house husbands is waiting to see how food costs are likely to be disrupted by the drought that's crippling many corn and soybean farmers.
And we thought that was the perfect subject for Money Matters. That's our regular segment exploring how the news of the day affects your pocketbook. With me to talk about this is Patty Hirsch. He's the senior producer of our personal finance show, Marketplace Money. Welcome, Patty.
Hello, Stacey.
So, Patty, we've heard a lot about the effect this drought will have on the global food chain, mm-hmm. especially because we're such big exporters of corn and soy.
Right.
But how about food prices in our supermarkets? Are we going to see those affected?
We are. It does depend, really, on how long the drought lasts and how much more severe it's going to get. You know, corn prices have risen maybe 45% over the summer so far. So that's pushing up the price of all sorts of food products. But it's really pushing up the price of meat and other animal-related goods. Right now, we can expect the price of meat to rise as much as 5%. And for dairy goods to rise between 2 and 4%.
That's because corn is being used as feed?
Exactly. And we can start to see those prices rise within the next couple of months or so. You'll probably see it in eggs and other dairy first.
Why eggs and dairy first?
Well, because of the short time between when those animals consume the corn, the feed, and when those products hit the markets. Obviously, you know, the chickens are eating the feed, bam, they pop out an egg. It's a lot more quick for that to take place than it is to, say, box up a box of cornflakes and put them up on the shelves.
Right, and then I guess the actual chicken comes later, the meat?
Yeah, meat is next. Although, weirdly enough, you might see meat prices fall a little bit initially because some farmers are going to want to slaughter their livestock rather than having to pay the high cost of feed.
Patty, what about some of the other foods that are made from corn, like cereal and things like that?
Yeah, like your cornflakes. That's a lot of stuff, actually, you know, because of stuff that's made of corn syrup and that kind of thing. Some consumer groups estimate that as much as 75% of the foods that we buy in the supermarket contain corn.
Wow.
Yeah, so you'd think that with corn getting really expensive now, your cornflakes are going to get a lot more expensive too. The thing is that most of the cost comes from packaging, like marketing, distribution, all that stuff. So the price of corn is going to have to get really, really high before it really bumps up the price of a box of cornflakes.
So we might see just like a small bump in those kinds of foods.
Hopefully, although if the drought spreads, it could get worse. I mean, right now the drought's affecting only about a third of corn and soybean production. If it does spread and crops in states like North Dakota or Minnesota are affected, we could start to see prices go a lot higher in the future.
Patty Hirsch is the senior producer of our personal finance show, Marketplace Money. Thank you, Patty.
Thank you, Stacey.
So, Jeff, an 11-year-old boy boarded a flight from Manchester to Italy yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing, maybe.
That sounds normal.
Too significant
so far.
About that. Here's the kicker. He did not have a ticket or a passport.
Huh. Good airport security in Manchester.
I know. Yes. Well, as you can imagine, the airport is freaking out about this. Mm-hmm. But apparently the boy mingled with families at security and also mingled with a family at the gate. And he wasn't actually discovered until mid-flight.
Huh.
Yeah. Authorities say they don't know how it happened yet. They're still kind of trying to figure out what went wrong there. And we don't know actually why the boy got on the flight.
Well, where was he headed again?
He was headed to Rome.
Oh. And the kid knows where to take a good vacation.
He was a smart kid.
And a free one, apparently. But Rome, how about Greece? We keep hearing it's actually a fairly decent time to travel there.
I imagine.
Somewhat affordable, but not such a great time for everybody else in Greece. And I guess that goes for prisoners. The psychiatric ward at Greece's largest maximum security prison had just gotten a new pool. And I guess it was a beautiful 24-meter pool, had a built-in barbecue and a waterfall.
At the prison?
At the prison, yeah. Wow. Well, and that seems a little weird, and it's got to go. The Greek Justice Ministry said the pool was put in without permission, and it didn't meet safety standards. That's the nominal reason. But you have to wonder, of course, as I think you probably just did, if a new pool for convicts maybe looks a little extravagant when the rest of the country is going through this huge economic contraction.
Doesn't look too austere from here. Of course, we haven't seen it, but
we should say this was for psychiatric patients, you know, so there's a therapeutic justification to it. But in any case, it was not politically palatable, not surprisingly.
I imagine. Well, Jeff, finally, Twitter is getting into the movie business.
Very short movies, maybe.
They're going to have a new category at the Oscars. Actually, the social networking site is going to team up with some Hollywood producers and launch video series. I guess perhaps we would see them promoted on Twitter, and then we would click on the promotions and we would be taken to a special Twitter player.
Okay.
So they would not be super short, but they apparently would potentially respond to user tweets. So if you tweeted, you know, I really want Joe and Maria to get together, maybe mm-hmm. Joe and Maria would get together.
Interesting. Very 21st century. What are we going to call these things? What do you call them? Twoobies?
I like Twoobies.
Mitters?
Twilms? I guess it depends on if they're what the quality, really.
Yeah, well, we could do this all day, but we could, but we shouldn't. I'm Jeff Horowitz in Los Angeles.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.